Welcome to The Life and Times Of. This is a program where we get to meet some extraordinary people and find out about their life and times, and it's also about the music that has moved them, motivated, or even just been there to help them get through a time in their life. I'm Stephen Brown. With me today is Martin Benj. For us here at 927, Martin is the ultimate professional. His shows are loved by everyone, and his kindness and humbleness are no stranger. Let's meet the man who has spent time with so many musical artists, including recording the Beatles when he worked at the Abbey Road Studios. Thank you, Martin, for chatting with me today about your life and times. You're English, of course. From what part?
Yeah, I'm from the south of England, although I was born in London during the wartime years, 1944 to be precise, which is a bit of a giveaway, isn't it, for as far as how old I am? Yeah, and lived and grew up by the seaside in a little town called Bexhill-on-Sea in Sussex. And that's where I spent my whole childhood.
You went to school there?
Yep. I did, yes. Yep. Kindergarten originally, and then I went over to the local boarding school at Eastbourne College, and that was my secondary school, yeah. We got out of London after the war. Things were pretty tough. My dad lost his work because of the difficulty with the stock exchange sort of collapsing in around 1946-47, and then we moved down to Bexhill to live with my grandparents in the most idyllic seaside town, Bexhill-on-Sea. So lucky to be there. And that was in 1948, and we were in Bexhill for many, many years until I eventually moved to London to pursue my interests in electronics and music.
You've selected from this era of your life Ray Conniff, his orchestra and singers, with Everybody Loves Somebody. What was it about Ray Conniff that, well, made you buy his records?
Everybody loves somebody sometimes.
I'm glad you asked. Well, in the 1960s, we had a record player at home, and I was always going to buy records on a Saturday morning with my pocket money. And I went down to the record store one Saturday morning, and I hadn't seen many double albums before, and there was a double album of Ray Conniff with all these lovely tunes on it that Mum and Dad used to like. And I thought, well, this would be a nice record to bring home, and Mum and Dad will enjoy listening to it rather than, you know, incessant Beatles and Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd, which was what we were playing, of course, in the 1960s. And so I turned up home with a Ray Conniff record, this one I bought, and put it on. And it was a lot better than I expected. I thought it was absolutely fabulous. And I've become a tremendous Ray Conniff fan ever since. Ray Conniff was a fascinating musician. He was a trombone player himself and played in many of the big bands during the 1930s and 40s. Went on to become a great arranger. And his orchestrations involve a lot of vocal performances, but the vocalists are not actually singing words. They're mimicking the lines of some of the instruments in the orchestra, like the brass instruments or the woodwinds, and he's used his singing choir, his vocal group, the Ray Conniff Singers, to mimic some of the instruments in the orchestra, and it just creates a fascinating sound. And it's little known that he was also a fantastic record producer. Now, he produced that backing on Guy Mitchell's Singin' the Blues. And it's trademark Ray Conniff. It's got all his signatures in it. This kind of shuffle beat, there's somebody whistling in it, and it's just so catchy. And Ray Conniff is a guy that will make a tune incredibly catchy.
Because everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine. The dream is gone I thought was mine.
When did the fascination with things electrical start and become the genesis of your electrical and sound engineering career?
Well, I'd always been absolutely fascinated with anything electrical. Don't ask me why. I think it all started with a wind-up gramophone, which sort of contradicts the electrical myth, but we had a wind-up HMV gramophone at home belonging to my grandparents and a whole lot of 78s, and it was like a toy, you know. We were just kids, and my sister and I used to play with this thing, and we didn't really understand what it did originally, but I became absolutely intrigued with the way sound emanated from this thing when you put a record on, and I think that was the beginning of my lifelong fascination with recorded sound, although at the time I didn't really know it. And then I moved on to an electrical record player, which Mum and Dad bought for my sister and I for Christmas in the early 1950s. And of course, that changed everything. Electrical gramophone, you know, this was a scientific wonder in those days. And of course, along came the microgroove records, the 45s and the LPs, 33 and a third, and EPs. And the 78s got slowly discarded over the years, and we moved on to records that sounded a hell of a lot better.
What were you listening to then?
Well, Mum and Dad loved the artists of the 1940s, like, Doris Day, Vera Lynn, Nat King Cole, Peggy Lee. And I've gone on to love those artists tremendously, even at this stage of my life. You know, I really do love that music.
Unforgettable, that's what you are. Unforgettable, though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me. How the thought of you does things to me. Never before has someone been more unforgettable in every way. And forevermore, that's how you'll stay. That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
You're now 16, ready to leave school. Your parents get you an interview with a friend of theirs who is an engineer at EMI. How did that go?
I was nervous as hell. And anyway, the interview was a bit of a disaster. At the end of it, Dr. Cairns was this chap's name. He was an eminent electronics expert in the valve technology that EMI were working with in those days. And he said to my dad, he said, well, look, he said, Mr. Benge, he said, I'm afraid your son is just not qualified to start as an apprentice with our company. And he really needs to go and do an electrical engineering course or at least A-levels at school before we'd even consider him. So that was that. And we went away from that interview. My tail was well and truly between my legs, and I'd sort of almost given up hope. But we got home and sorted it all out, had a long chat about it, and I decided that what I should do really was go to technical college. I should leave school and go to technical college and do electrical engineering for a couple of years and come back to EMI with a certificate or sort of piece of paper that said I knew something about electronics. And that's what happened. And they took me on as a electrical engineering apprentice in the EMI electronics division at Hayes, Middlesex, which is where all the electrical stuff used to go on. They built things like medical scanners and airborne radar systems for defence. But of course, it was a music company as well, and they built sound equipment and they made tape and tape recorders and lots of the equipment that went into recording studios. So it was a multifaceted company with something like 7,000 employees worldwide in about 15 or 16 countries. Huge organization. And I was just a humble little kid, you know, at 17, working my way through the intricacies of the apprentice scheme. And during that time, we spent 3 months in different departments in the company. And eventually, I got a stint in the department at the factory that were building mixing consoles and the stuff for the recording studios in different parts of the world. And I thought I'd found my niche, really, at that point. Moving on from that, I managed to get a 3 month stint up at the Abbey Road Studios.
Oh.
Which was very, very exciting, because as soon as I walked into that place on my first day, I suddenly found somewhere where I wanted to spend the rest of my working life.
And you got to work with the Beatles on some or many of their big hits.
Well, I started at EMI in 1962 as the apprentice, you know, and that was 1962 that they signed the Beatles. They signed the Beatles that year. I didn't sort of come across them until I'd gone up to the studios, obviously, which was a little bit later on in 65, 66. And from then onwards, we worked side by side, because they were in the studios pretty well continuously for the 8 years of the time that they were together as a band. And I was there for quite a fair chunk of that. I was the recording engineer on Across the Universe.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
I'd been on the technical side at the studios prior to that, installing equipment and working on the recording sessions, but in a technical capacity rather than a sound engineer capacity. But I really wanted to get into sound engineering, and in 1967 I managed to persuade the management to let me transfer over to the recording side, and did my first recording session. And then in 68 we recorded, I got it, you know, to do the Across the Universe session with the Beatles. The whole recording of Across the Universe was probably spread over a few weeks. I recorded the basic tracks on the first day with the band, and then it went on from there to be had lots of overdubs put on it, and quite a bit of editing and mixing, and I wasn't involved in all the after post-production processes, but my work was done on that first day in Studio 3.
Did George Martin have an influence on those recordings?
Well, he was producing them, yeah. He was in charge. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he, I think, suggested to the boys that Ken Scott was doing the original recording sessions for that album, The Let It Be, and he got sick, and they were looking for someone to step in and do the session that Sunday afternoon. And George Martin put it to the boys that maybe they'd like to give me a go. And that was how I got, you know, a chance to actually record the Beatles. They knew me from having been there several years before on the technical side. I was in and out of those sessions anyway, so, you know, it was first name terms, and I didn't have to sort of get introduced or anything, but I was just, instead of wearing the white coat technical stuff, that was thrown out and I was wearing a suit and tie and mixing the music. It was great fun.
What were the Beatles like individually? Were they good blokes, easy to get along with, or had the fame already got to them?
Well, look, I mean, when they first started at Abbey Road, they were just a real bunch of fun guys, you know. It was all jokes and humour, and then, you know, as time went on and they became more and more famous, it affected them dramatically. I mean, the story is fairly familiar, I think, to those who, you know, are interested in the Beatles. I think they were affected by the fame more than anything, but there were other factors that came into it as well. Their recording relationship with EMI was tense because they were signed to a pretty miserly contract that favoured the company. They were getting a very small percentage of royalties, and they weren't very happy about that. And that all had to change, and in fact, it eventually did. And then they started to make vast amounts of money, and they started experimenting with all sorts of weird substances, and that kind of changed everything, really. And the sessions, instead of being the traditional 3 hours in the studio to produce three songs, which was the format for years, the sessions would go on day and night, and maybe not produce anything significant for, you know, a whole week. But then when the chips were down, they could really turn it on and deliver some great music. I mean, great songwriters, the Lennon-McCartney team. And of course, Harrison was a great songwriter as well in his own right. And they just had this ability to churn out incredible songs that sustained that production of all these albums and singles throughout that period.
You would have seen some major changes to sound recording over the years, and even over the 8 years you were working with the Beatles.
Indeed. Well, and the studios really, I think, largely due to bands like Pink Floyd and the Beatles, who really wanted to experiment with the technology. And the old four-track machines and the earlier ways of doing things were just not up to the job of dealing with these new ideas that the artists were coming up with during the recording sessions. And we always felt we were, you know, a little bit behind the eight ball trying to come up with the technology. But some of the engineers at the studios were very innovative. I'll mention Jeff Emerick, who recorded most of the Beatles records during that period of time, and he was you know, thrown a lot of curveballs by the Beatles once they started working with him. John Lennon wanted to sound like the Maharishi on a mountaintop in Nepal on his vocals, and it was Jeff's job to come up with something. So he put the voice through a Leslie speaker on the Hammond organ, and a bit of reverb, and John thought he was the best thing since sliced bread, you know, once he came up with that sound.
Clever bloke.
So all sorts of things happened, you know. We had to use what we got to its greatest extent, sometimes frowned upon by the management, who had, you know, technical policies that they felt should be followed, but they weren't always.
You also worked on some other famous Beatles tracks.
I worked on Day in the Life, but that was really before my time doing Across the Universe. And the Day in the Life and All You Need Is Love, I worked on that session as well, the big orchestra, and that was very, very exciting.
You can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game.
All You Need Is Love was the first, was a worldwide huge simulcast. It was huge. It probably would have been around 1966.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was the my job on that session was running the echo machine, because we used tape echo as part of the reverberation chain. And my job on that session was not only to, because I was still on the technical side, but I was overseeing the operation of all the systems in the control room that day. If anything broke down, then it would be my problem. But I was also running the echo machine so that it didn't run out of tape at a crucial time, because this thing was live, you know.
It was.
We were all nervous as hell because we weren't used to live stuff. You know, we were always able to go and do it again if it was in the studio on a recording session. But this was going out to, you know, 50 million people around the world. Nerve-wracking session, that one.
End of part one.